Haridas Thakur ki jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan ki jai. Vrindavan Dham ki jai. Mathura Dham ki jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dham ki jai. Jagannath Puri Dham ki jai. Gangi Manjuna Devi ki jai. Bhakti Devi ki jai. Tulsi Maharani ki jai. Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaur Vrindavananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Krishnaya Kutulashi Mati Bhakti Vinata Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gaurani Vachani Vasesa Samadhi Pasapari Satana. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Utapada Kamalam Shri Guru and Vaishnavam Shri Rupam Sadhujatam Sahajana Raghunatam Gitam Samsajivam Sadvaitam Sadhujitam Parijana Sahita Krishna Jay Jenny Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Raita Shri Vishakam Gitam Shri Vanchakapa Chubhishchaki Vasimbe Vichamati Chanam Bhavane Vaishnavam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Zagreb, Croatia. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 20, Bali Maharaj Surrenders Universe, Text 6. This is one of my favorite verses in Bhagavatam. This is a verse that I've often used to guide my decision makings. Yad yad dasyasi lokesmin.
Yad yad dasyasi lokesmin.
Samparetam danadikam.
Samparetam danadikam.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Please chant.
Yadyadhasyati lokesmin.
Yadyadhasyati lokesmin.
Samparetam danadikam.
Samparetam danadikam.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Yadyadasyati lokesmin.
Yadyadasyati lokesmin.
Samparetam danadikam.
Samparetam danadikam.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Viprastusyena tena.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Yadyadasyati lokesmin.
Samparetam danadikam. Tasya tyage nimittam kim. Viprastusyena tena chet.
Yadyadasyati lokesmin.
Yadyadasyati lokesmin.
Samparetam danadikam.
Samparetam danadikam.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Yadyadasyati lokesmin.
Yadyadasyati lokesmin.
Samparetam danadikam.
Samparetam danadikam.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Viprastusyena tena chet.
Yadyadasyati
lokesmin.
Samparetam danadikam. Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Tasya tyage nimittam kim.
Yat yat.
Whatsoever.
Hasyati.
Will leave.
Loke.
In the world.
Asmin.
In this.
Samparitam.
One who is already dead.
Dana adikam.
His wealth and riches.
Tasya.
Of such wealth.
Tyage.
In renunciation.
Nimittam.
The purpose.
Kim.
What is?
Vipraha.
The Brahmana who is confidentially Lord Vishnu.
Tusyat.
Must be pleased.
Na.
Is not.
Tena.
By such riches.
Chet.
If there is a possibility.
So we're continuing with Bali Maharaj's explanations to Sukracharya as to why he's going to keep his promise. So he said, what was his reason yesterday? Anybody remember what was his reason yesterday?
He's afraid of rejecting, to displeasing Brahmana.
So he's not afraid of anything except displeasing Brahmana, and the day before that, what was his reason? Yes, you're looking.
Yeah.
So the worst adharma is to be untruthful. Okay, so today he's going to give another reason. Translation. My Lord, speaking to Sukracharya, you can also see that all the material opulences of this world are certainly separated from their possessor at death. Therefore, if the Brahman Vamandev is not satisfied by whatever gifts one has given, why not please him with the riches one is destined to lose at death? So what is this logic here? Somebody explain to me.
You're going to lose your wealth anyway at the time of death, so why not get rid of some useful purpose?
Exactly. You're going to lose your wealth anyway at the time of death, why not use it for something? You're not going to be able to hold on to it anyway. Purport. The word vipra means brahmana and at the same time confidential. Bali Maharaja had confidentially decided to give the gift to Lord Vamana without discussion. But because such a decision would hurt the hearts of the asuras and his spiritual master Sukracharya, he spoke equivocally. Bali Maharaja, as a pure devotee, had already decided to give all the land to Lord Vishnu. So he's already made the decision and he's trying to pacify the demons and his guru by giving these reasons. And he's not saying, yes, I recognize this is Vamandev, who's Lord Vishnu, and I'm going to give everything to Lord Vishnu, because that would have made them unhappy. So he just says, I'm going to give it to this Brahmana. Yad yad dasyasi lokesmin samparetam dinadikam tasya chage nimittam kim viprastusyan natena chet. So this verse reminds me of something that my mother used to often say. She said, better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. Better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. She didn't mean better to give lovingly than unlovingly. She meant better to give while you're alive rather than to give after you're dead. So generally in this world, we're very attached to our wealth and possessions. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, because that was one of the things that Bali said he wasn't afraid of. He said he wasn't afraid of poverty. Yesterday he says, Nadanya, danya means wealth. I'm not afraid of losing my wealth. He also said yesterday that he wasn't afraid. I mean, not yesterday for him, yesterday for us. He said it all in the same day for him. But he said, I'm not afraid of losing my wealth, and I'm not afraid of death. But most of us are very afraid of both of these things. If you think, you know, what are the biggest fears for materialistic people? It's poverty and death, among other things which we mentioned yesterday, which he also mentioned, hellish conditions, falling from our position, and so forth. But in studies of what are people's biggest fears,
I mean, sometimes people say their biggest fears is public speaking, but generally people's biggest fears is that they're going to run out of money before they die, that somehow they'll get to a point in life where they have no money. Because people feel that their money and their possessions is one of their main shelters, isn't it? Yes, we have different fallible soldiers. One of our fallible soldiers is our body itself. Just like Lord Vishnu said to Vrikasura, you have to take care of your body, because without your body, how are you going to fulfill your desires? So our main fallible soldier is our body, which proves, at least for me on a daily basis, how fallible it is. And sometimes very extremely so. And then, of course, our mind, our talents, our knowledge, that's another one of our fallible soldiers. Then our family, well, they'll take care of me even if my body breaks and I lose my mind. Still my family will take care of me. My community, my society, my country, my government will take care of me. I can count on there being water when I turn on the faucet and electricity when I turn on the switch. And I can count on walking on the streets without being attacked because my government is taking care of me. And my wealth and my possessions. So these will take care of me. And we put a lot of emphasis on each of these. We're going to look specifically, of course, today at one's wealth and one's possessions. So this is a big thing, again, for most people. People have a retirement account. I want to earn enough money so that I can live comfortably, so that I can have a little bit more than what I need. And of course, this is reasonable. Just like when Rupa Goswami retired and he divided his wealth, he gave half of his wealth to the brahmanas, one-fourth to his family, and one-fourth he kept aside for emergencies. And Srila Prabhupada told Harisari, Prabhu, when Harisari was Prabhupada's servant, and Harisari used his own money to buy a dhoti, and Prabhupada said, no, I'll buy you a dhoti. He said, you should save your money for emergencies. Same when Harisari used his own money to buy airfare. Prabhupada said, no, you're my servant, I'll take care of you, save your money for emergencies. So this concept that one should have something put aside for emergencies and that one should have enough wealth to live comfortably is there even among the majority of devotees in the Shastra. Yes, correct? Right? When Srivas Thakur, Mahaprabhu asked Srivas Thakur, what are you doing for a livelihood? I never see you going to work. And you don't have a job. And I don't think you had a rich family, you don't have an inheritance. What are you doing for your income? And Srivas Thakur says, I have a 1-2-3 policy. And Mahaprabhu was wondering, what is this 1-2-3? And he says, well, one day, if nobody gives me any donation, if I don't get any food donated, then we'll fast. 2 days, if nobody donates any food to my family, we'll fast. And 3 days, if nobody donates any food or goods to my family, I'll just jump in the Ganga. And Mahaprabhu said, no. He said, Lakshmi Devi herself may have to go around with a begging bowl, but you will always be taken care of. And so sometimes you have devotees, even household devotees, who are doing this sort of situation. And we were talking yesterday about Ranti Dev, who, again, I don't really understand how somebody could be a king and be poverty-stricken. Maybe he was the king of a very, very poor kingdom. I mean, he didn't even have any water to drink. So I'm not quite sure how he could be a king without water to drink, but he had no food and no water. And he made no endeavor, even as a king, to do anything for his own maintenance. Just whatever came. Yes? That was his mood. And he and his family were practically starving. They were at the point of death. We find Sudama Brahmana was also like this. Sudama Brahmana just studied the scriptures and taught the scriptures, worshipped the deities, and he made no effort to gain any kind of income, although he was a household. And he said, again, he and his wife, they were so thin from not having enough food, and she was even shaking due to hunger and malnutrition. And still he didn't make any effort to get any kind of wealth. Even when he went to see Krishna, he didn't ask Krishna for money. Generally if we go to the home of a wealthy person, we may talk to them about their children and their dog and their business, and but then we come to the whole point, and excuse me, can you give a donation for a new temple or something like that? Sudama Brahma didn't do that with Krishna. He just talked about old times and gave him a little bit of poor quality rice, which was all he had, and then he went home, and he was happy, and he thought, you know, why should I ask Krishna for anything? And he could have just offered me something. He saw how poor I was. It said, you know, his clothes, he was even dirty. So, you know, why are poor people dirty? They can't even buy laundry soap, you know, to wash their clothes. But Krishna didn't offer him anything, and he thought, well, that's good. I'm obviously too immature. He thought it's only the mature devotees who get the wealth, and Krishna knew that I wouldn't deal with it properly. So, of course, then he came home and he had a little surprise waiting for him at home. But this was his mood. Right? And we see this also, of course, sometimes with sannyasis. We see Madhavini Puri who didn't beg for anything. Generally, the sannyasis will beg. Even Mahaprabhu, as a sannyasi, was begging. When he was touring South India, he was going out begging. And Jagannath Puri, Kashi Vishwanath, King Pariparudra, arranged for prasadam to be brought to his home and everything he needed. But when he was on tour, he would go begging. But Madhavini Puri did not beg. If somebody gave him food, he'd take it, and if they didn't give him food, then he would fast. Of course, then he came to Vrindavan, and Krishna came as a little boy and said, why are you fasting? He said, how did you know I was fasting? Because those things don't work if you advertise it. You know, if you go around, does everyone say, I'm not asking for food. I'm just waiting for whoever feeds me. You know, that's good. Gets rid of the whole point of the thing. So he doesn't tell anybody that he's fasting. And Krishna comes and gives him milk, and he says, here in Vrindavan, I am the proprietor, and in my village, no one fasts. So he gave him some milk. Of course, Madhavini Puri took a little while to understand that that was Krishna bringing him the milk. So we can understand why a sannyasi would do this. This is the mood of a sannyasi. But it's interesting that sometimes even the household of devotees, they don't make any effort to get an income. That may be there. But generally speaking, that is not the case. So generally speaking, just like Mahaprabhu told Sri Vasudeva, why don't you have a job? And then there was Vasudeva Dutt. Vasudeva Dutt gave away all of his money in charity all the time. He was constantly giving away all of his money in charity, and there wasn't enough for his family. And Mahaprabhu went to Sivananda Sen, and said, you know, Vasudeva Dutt is so liberal, he gives so much in charity that his family are in difficulty. So would you please manage his finances for him? So Mahaprabhu didn't want, in general, his devotees, especially his householders, to live like that. And we have the story of Gopinath Patanayaka. So Gopinath Patanayaka is one of the five sons of Bhavananda Roy. He was a tax collector for the government. And in those days, the way that the tax collectors made their money was they took a commission directly from the tax money. So nowadays, the tax collectors work in an office, and they get paid a salary, and they don't directly touch the money that comes in taxes. But in those days, the tax collectors would go, I'm sure not personally, I'm sure they had their agents, but they would go to people's homes and collect the money, the cash, the taxes. Sometimes it wasn't money. Just like the Nandamars was paying taxes in milk and butter and yogurt and things like that, they would collect the taxes, and then they would keep a portion for themselves, and then they would hand over the rest to the government. So there was some problem that Gopinath Patanayaka was short. He hadn't given enough to the government. He had kept too much. So this problem happens among governments in general, doesn't it? Yes, and they pocket something for themselves, a little over what they're supposed to. And he got in trouble with the king, not so much with Maharaj Pratiparudra, but more with Maharaj Pratiparudra's son. So there was some bad feeling between Gopinath Patanayaka and the son, one of the sons of Maharaj Pratiparudra. So Gopinath Patanayaka said, yes, you're right, I took too much, and I don't have it right now. I'm broke. I don't have anything. But I have some very valuable horses. So let me give these horses to the government as a partial payment of my debt, and I'll pay the rest of the debt later. And he set a value on the horses, but the king's son saw the horses and said, they're not worth as much as you're claiming they're worth. They were disagreeing on the value of the horses. And Gopinath Patanayaka said, well, you're wrong. They're really good horses. They don't turn around and look up at the sky. And he said that because the prince had a habit when he was speaking, he's talking to you, while he's talking to you, he would do this. So Gopinath Patanayaka was making fun of the prince. You know, well, these white horses don't look up at the sky. And the prince got very offended. And he said, you're trying to cheat the government by putting too high of a price on the horses and taking this money, and therefore you should be executed. So just imagine, I mean, to execute somebody for something like that. So he put him up on what's called a chunga. He put him on a platform where then one of their methods of execution, we wouldn't do this today in our democratic countries for sure, but one of their methods of execution was you'd stand on a high platform and on the ground there were swords with the point up and they would throw you down on top of the swords and that's how you'd die. It would be a painful, slow death, I would imagine. Not something, you know, kind of death. So he's standing up on the chanda and some of the devotees run and tell Mahaprabhu, 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 Gopinath Patanayaka is up on the chanda, he's going to be killed. And Mahaprabhu says, why are you bothering me with this? If he's stolen money for the government, then that's his problem. I don't want to be disturbed. Ah, I was just thinking about you. I was just thinking, when will I see you? So he was saying, don't disturb me with this, don't disturb me with this. And I don't remember how many times, 3 or 5 times, various people came to Mahaprabhu and told him, you know, this is, and Lord Chaitanya kept saying, stop bothering me. He said, I'm a sannyasi, I shouldn't be involved in political affairs, which is, by the way, a very big lesson for renunciates are not meant to be involved in political affairs, even among the devotees. He said, you know, if you have a problem, why don't you just talk to Lord Jagannath about it? That's what he said. He said, go talk to Lord Jagannath about it. So then one of the devotees, and he said, if anybody talks to me about this again, I'm going to leave Jagannath Puri. That was one of his common threats. If people were disturbing him with things, especially with trying to entangle him with politics. So one devotee went to the king and said, Mahaprabhu says, and he was Kashi Mishra, said, Mahaprabhu says that he'll leave Jagannath Puri. And the king, what? Lord Chaitanya will leave Jagannath Puri? But yes, he's been very disturbed that people are complaining about the situation with Gopinath Patanayaka. Oh, what's the situation? Oh, your son has put him up on the chunga. Put him on the chunga. I don't want him executed. I just want him to pay his money. What is he doing? Why is he doing this without my authorization? Go take him off the chunga and bring him here. Anyway, what ended up happening is that the king ended up excusing Gopinath Patanayaka of all of his debts, letting him keep his horses, raising his salary. He said, if you're taking too much money, you must not have enough money. He doubled his salary, and he increased his position. He gave him a higher position. He gave him a position of honor and gave him a silk wrapper. And then when that news was brought to Lord Chaitanya, he said, that wasn't what I wanted. He said, you know, I didn't look for his debt to be excused and for him to get a higher position. You know, why has all this happened? Anyway, then Bhavananda Roy and his 5 sons came to see Lord Chaitanya, and Gopinath Patanayaka came with the honor and the silk wrapper on his head, and you know, and they're falling at Mahaprabhu's feet. And Lord Chaitanya said at that time some very important instructions. He said, you should make sure you earn your money honestly. Don't earn your money dishonestly. Don't cheat. And then he also said very clearly, he said, I don't want all of my followers to be renunciates. He said, if everybody is a renunciate, then how will life go on? And he said, I want you to earn money. Don't give up your occupation. He said this also when Maharaj Pratiparuja wanted to renounce the kingdom. He said, the king should not renounce the kingdom. I want devotees in such positions. So he said, go and earn money honestly and do not cheat the king. And take care of your family and take care of the society. So the point of this whole story, and there's many points, but the point in regard to today's verse, is that generally speaking, householder devotees are supposed to have an honest livelihood and they are supposed to be making money. The brahmacharis are not supposed to be making money. Whatever money they collect, they give to their guru and their guru maintains them. And the vanaprasthas, of course, are retired from making money, just like in the everyday world, a retired person retires from their job, and the sannyasis, of course, are dead, and dead people don't make money. So the only people who are making money are the grihasthas, and the grihasthas are supposed to make enough money to maintain their family, as well as to give charity to the society. That's the idea. We have in the later part of the Bhagavatam, there's a story of one brahmana who was such a miser that not only did he not give charity, but he didn't even spend his money on maintaining his family. He just hoarded it. And because of this, he suffered very greatly. Right? His family ended up abusing him, and he was very much mistreated by people in general. That's considered very sinful if you don't spend your money even for the maintenance of your family. But the problem is that even though one is supposed to do this, one is supposed to have an honest livelihood, and one is supposed to keep some money in reserve generally among the householders, sometimes a Brahmin householder is not supposed to keep anything in reserve if the Brahmin householder lives entirely on charity. So householders in general are not supposed to live on charity, but if the Brahmana lives entirely on random charity, then the sacrifice for that is that you don't keep any stock for the next day. That is, whatever you haven't used that day, you immediately give away. It's such a householder is almost living like a renunciate. But generally, the householders have some income, and they use that for their family, and they use some for emergencies, and they also give in charity. Generally, they don't give everything. Generally, the householders don't give this argument and say, well, I'm going to lose everything at death. I might as well give it all away now. Right? But the problem is that one becomes attached to one's wealth as a fallible soldier. That one starts thinking, my wealth is going to protect me. My wealth is going to be my shelter. And one starts thinking that it's my wealth, that just because I've earned it, therefore it belongs to me. Now this doesn't tend to happen so much in the renounced ashrams. First of all, because in the renounced ashrams, you're not earning any wealth at all. The brahmachari is not earning wealth, the brahmachari is begging wealth, which belongs to the guru. The vanaprastha is engaged in austerity, the sannyasi is engaged in teaching, vanaprastha may also be engaged in teaching. Prabhupada said the business of those in the renounced orders is to engage in learned discourses and to publish transcendental literature. But they're not doing anything to maintain themselves. They're not seeing, the vanaprastha and the sannyasi is not seeing that, oh, I'm doing something to earn a livelihood. That they're not thinking in those terms at all. They're just thinking, I'm doing some service, and however Krishna maintains me, he maintains me. The varna, the concept of varna or livelihood, only applies in the Grihastha ashram. It doesn't apply in the other ashrams. In fact, if a person feels that they can skip the Grihastha ashram, they can go directly from the Brahmachari ashram to the Vanaprastha or to the Sannyas ashram, one of the things that they're giving up is varna. So not only are they giving up sex and home and like that, but they're also giving up varna. If somebody wants to have some activities as a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra in the world, then they should get married. And that's one of the principles. But anyway, the Vanaprastha and Sannyasi, whatever they're doing, they're not thinking in terms of livelihood. They're thinking, I'm just engaging in the nine processes of devotional service, and the Lord is maintaining me however he wants to maintain me. They don't do anything to maintain themselves. Although occasionally, again, they may beg. But even the begging of the renunciates is not really to maintain themselves, is it? Prabhupada explains the begging of the renunciate is just an excuse to go to people and preach to them. Just like in modern society, there's so many religious groups that go door to door and give you their literature. Do they do that here too in Persia? Like the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses especially do that. So traditionally, the Vaishnavas would also do that. But and they wouldn't just give literature, they would beg something. So that was their excuse. And people would open the door because they thought, oh, these renunciates, they have no means of maintenance. If I don't give them some milk, if I don't give them some rice, they're going to starve. The Buddhists also do this. And then while they're there on the excuse of getting their food, and by what I mean by excuse is such people are confident that the Lord will feed them. They're not feeling I have to be dependent on the householders. While they're there with the excuse of getting their food, they give some transcendental milk. And of course, they set an example for the householders of renunciation and what is the mentality of life. But in the householder ashram, which is an extremely important ashram, without it, the rest of society is going to immediately fall apart. One has to be careful about being attached to one's wealth. I mean, even in the other ashrams, one can be attached to one's possessions. It's not that brahmacharis, vanaprasthas, and sannyasis have no attachment to their possessions. You know, I was reading about this accident recently that happened in northern India where there was a bus that fell into the Bhagirathi River and a number of people drowned. Some devotees also drowned, one devotee's missing, some got very seriously injured. And of course, all their possessions were washed away. Right? They had to go back to the embassy, try to get a new passport and things like that. And I was thinking, oh, I wouldn't want all my possessions to be washed away. What would happen? Do we think like that? I mean, even if you just, all I have is one little suitcase full of possessions. But still I think, oh, if I lost that, what would I do? If I lost my computer, what would I do? I lost my passport, what would I do? So even if you just have a few possessions, you think like that. This is my shelter, this is what I need. I have to keep it, I have to take care of it, I have to protect it. But when one thinks like that, one is filled with anxiety, isn't it? A constant anxiety. Oh, I have to take care of this, I have to take care of this, otherwise what will I do, what will I do, what will I do? So therefore, no matter what ashram one is in, one should always remember that death is one's constant companion. And we usually think about death as something very fearful. Death is what's going to take away everything that we've accumulated. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. All of our investments. So what are we investing in? We invest a tremendous amount in our body, yes? How many hours a day do we spend just taking care of our body? I mean, if you count the endeavor it takes to cook and to clean up and to get food, and if we were growing our own food and so much and taking care of our shelter, I mean, it's a tremendous amount of energy we invest in our body, and how much we invest in our mind, how much we invest in our relationships in this world with family and friends, in our career. I mean, we're investing so much, and it's all going to be gone. It's all going to be gone. Finished. Right? I told this yesterday, but many of you weren't here. So we used to do this drama called The Wrong Bank Account, where this one man every week would put some money into savings. He'd get his paycheck and he'd put some of it into a savings account. And then when he went to retire, he goes to the bank and said, now I'd like all my money. And they said, well, you don't have any money, sir. He said, what happened? They said, you were putting it into someone else's account. So for the materialistic person, this is exactly what happens at the time of death. For a person who's never done anything in spiritual life, at the time of death, all of a sudden you realize that my entire life I've been putting my money into an account that has nothing to do with me. You know, and it's very frightening. It's very, very frightening. And I told this before, that how people who have near-death experiences, very often, probably about half the time, when they rise above their body and they look at their body, they don't recognize it as their body. They float out of their body and look down on their body and they think, wow, that lady just got in a really bad car accident. She looks like she's a mess. And then after some time, oh, that's my body. So that's what happens at death. I mean, even right before death, if a person has a warning of death, just like Steve Jobs when he was diagnosed with cancer, he said, as soon as you're facing death immediately, he said, everything really becomes clear, what's important and what's not important. Like the Tirthaswami wrote this also. He said, death takes away everything that's false. You really, really see what's important. My god sister, Mekala, as soon as she got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, she stopped a lot of her activities, just immediately. And her husband was saying that, you know, immediately, as soon as she got that diagnosis, there were a whole bunch of things that she had been doing that she just simply stopped. One, because as soon as you face death, you understand, well, this is useless. Well, this is useless. What am I doing this for? And this is just depositing something in an account that it's not really mine. It doesn't belong to me. I'm putting it, and it doesn't belong to anybody else either. I mean, what is the body? We say all the time, what is the body? It's going to become like a pile of ashes, or a pile of dirt, or some animal eats it, a pile of stool. You're pouring all your, you know, all your resources into that, all your energy into that. That's pretty crazy. You know, I've got a pile of ashes sitting there, and I'm just putting all my energy into this pile of ashes. So as death comes, you start to see that. You start to become aware. What am I doing that for? And all these things I'm collecting, they're not mine. I'm not taking them with me. They have nothing to do with me whatsoever. So therefore, why not give to Krishna those things that we're going to lose anyway at the time of death? Therefore. I mean, it's a funny thing when you think about death sitting next to you all the time, which it very much is, no matter how old you are and how healthy you are. You know, sometimes that, as I say, that may induce people, well, let me just stop earning a living and just, you know, I'll go sit at Radhakund and chant Hare Krishna. But that's not what Mahaprabhu wants. That's not what Srila Prabhupada wants. But we should develop this mood of sannyas. Bali Marsh is also a householder, but everyone should have this mood of sannyas. Whether we formally take sannyas or not is irrelevant. But we should have this mood that there's no point in investing anything in a pile of ashes at all. There's no point. Invest everything only in Krishna. Otherwise, anything that I invest in ashes, I'm going to lose it. Because it's not mine. Anything I invest in this designation, in this upadi, is false. Anything. Anything I try to keep for this designation is not going to stay with me. Anything I do to build up this identity, I am this body, I am this mind, I am belonging to this family, I am belonging to this country, I have this particular kind of career, I have this, anything we invest in that, it doesn't, we're going to lose it. And we're going to lose it, we may lose it, frankly, in 5 minutes. We have no idea. Youth and health have no guarantee. Some people live to, you know, 120 in a terribly sick body, and some people die at the age of 10 in a healthy body, yes? Nothing to do with it. And if we think this way, we see death as our friend and not as our enemy. It's like we were talking about yesterday, that why does Bali Maharaj not fear poverty, and he doesn't fear hell, and he doesn't fear death? Because the devotees often see these as friends. The devotees voluntarily take sannyas as a friend. They don't see it as an enemy. And death is an ichusarvastaha. I am death, Krishna said. Just like Prahlad Maharaj, he saw Nrisimhadeva as his friend. Hiranyakashipu saw Nrisimhadeva as his enemy, but Prahlad saw Nrisimhadeva as his friend. So we can also see that death is our friend. Death is a manifestation of Krishna. And this friend is with us all the time in conditioned life. Just like that story of the sword of Damocles. You all know that story? There was this king, Damocles, and he was enjoying. And one of his friends says, oh, you're enjoying so much. I'd like to be a king so I can enjoy. He says, you come. Sit here. You can watch all the dancing girls and eat all the food. And so his friend was there sitting in the king's throne. You know. And then at one point he looks up and he sees that there's this sword hanging by a thread from the ceiling. And he said, what's that? He said, oh, that comes with a job. He said, when you're a king, there's so many political enemies and threats of war and you can be killed at any time. And then his friend says, whoa, I think I'll get out of the chair. You know, and all of us have this sword of Damocles hanging on our head. So better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. Better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. That doesn't necessarily mean that we give away all of our wealth and our family members starve. But it means that we use everything for who we really are. We use everything for who we really are. We're not worried that I have to hold on to this or that or the other thing in order for my security in this world. Whether it's money here, we're particularly talking about money and possessions, use them in Krishna's service. That doesn't mean the householder shouldn't have any savings. I mean, even a renunciate, if they're working on some project, may have to have some savings. When we were producing our Learn to Read books, somebody would give me a donation for the artist, so I couldn't spend it all in one day. I had to spend it over many months and save it to pay the artist, you know, as they were coming up. But to use everything for Krishna without fear. Use my body for Krishna. Use my mind for Krishna. Use my family relationships for Krishna. My job for Krishna. My money for Krishna. My possessions for Krishna. Then I'm putting it in a bank account where I have it after death. Isn't that cool? Like Prabhupada told Guru Kripa, he said, oh, you built Krishna's house here in Vrindavan. He said, so Krishna's building you a house in the spiritual world. So what we do for Krishna does go with us, because that we're doing for our real self. Then we're putting something into our bank account. Just like the fruit seller, when she offered Krishna all of her fruits, she turned around, her basket was full of jewels. Of course, she didn't actually spend the jewels. She was so absorbed in prema that she just was dancing through Vrindavan and gave up her body on the bank of the Jamuna. But anyway, the point is there. It says in the Bhagavatam that when one gives something to the Lord, one is not a loser. One is a gainer by a million times. It's said that if we give even charity to an ordinary person, we get that charity back in equal measure later in this life or in a subsequent life. And in fact, whatever wealth we have in this life is coming from how charitable we have been in this life and in our previous lives. Someone who's wealthy in this life, they were charitable either previously in this life or in another life. That makes sense, doesn't it? Krishna is going to give wealth to people who don't use it selfishly. Isn't that reasonable? If you have many children and you give a toy to one child and they share it with their brothers and sisters, you'll be much more likely to give them more toys than if they say, "No, it's mine, no, it's mine." So if Krishna sees that you use your wealth only for yourself, then he'll give you just barely enough to live. If he sees you use your wealth for others, then he'll give you more wealth. Logical, yes? And if you give your charity to a worthy person, then it comes back 100 times. If you give it to a Brahmin, it comes back 1,000 times. And up to the point that if you give your charity to a Mahabhagavat, it comes back unlimited times. I mean, I've seen this practically, that if I give charity to devotees, I get it back. There was one devotee recently who said, I'm so poor, I really wish I could buy some good luggage. And myself being a traveler, I can understand why somebody wants good luggage. You remember we had our luggage the years ago. So I said, well, somebody give me a donation here. You take it and buy yourself some luggage. She says, how can you give it to me? I said, I'll get it back. And a week later, I got it back. So one, and that was funny. I thought, I knew I would get it back. So I've had this experience over and over and over again, that whatever you give to the devotees, whatever you give to Krishna, you're never a loser. Of course, one should be very careful that one gives with proper consciousness, that one doesn't give in the mode of passion or in the mode of ignorance. In the mode of ignorance, you give disrespectfully. Here you go. Here's your prasadam. Here's a donation. Or you give it the wrong time. You know, person's in the toilet or something. Hey, I want to give you a donation. I never knew. So, the wrong time, the wrong place, disrespectfully. And in the mode of passion, you're giving out of prestige. I've given so much to this temple. Where is my plaque on the wall? You have to treat me specially because I've given so much. Or also in the mode of passion, you don't want to give, but your authority says, you should give. I don't want to give. Why should I give? All right. You're my authority, I'll give. And later you think, why did I give so much? And that's true not only with money, that's true with time. Now, we've seen this sometimes with devotees. They'll just work totally for the mission for 5-10 years, and then they say, I gave the best years of my life, why did I give so much? I should have been working on my career, I should have been going to school, things like that. So that's charity in the mode of passion. So one should give with peace and happiness. Of one's time, of one's effort, of one's talents and one's money, of one's dealings and one's relationships, everything that one should be doing should be given. How you deal with your children should be a gift to Krishna. How you deal with your wife, with your husband, that should be a gift to Krishna. How you take care of our, so-called our body, that should be done for Krishna. Krishna, this body is yours. Bhumirapanalava yukamanovita. This body is made of your energy. Whatever I'm doing for you. However I spend whatever money Krishna gives me, that I do for you. However I take care of the things Krishna gives me, that I do for your pleasure. Then we're putting our money in the right bank account. Then everything that we give stays with us. It's real. And it's not a source of anxiety. Because if I'm giving it to Krishna, what does it matter? If Krishna gives me 1 euro to give him, or Krishna gives me 1,000 euros to give him, it really doesn't matter. Either way, I have the same pleasure of giving to Krishna, isn't it? Does it matter? One can get just as much pleasure giving the deities, you know, one marigold flower as giving the deities a new altar. Don't you have this experience? So whatever Krishna gives me to give him, really he's giving me to give him, like your parents give you some money and you use the money to buy a gift for your parents. You know, you all did that when you were little? My poor father, I bought him so many ties. He would always say thank you. Oh, where did I get the money to buy the tie? And we got it from him. So whatever Krishna gives us to use in his service, we enjoy using in his service. We're not trying to keep it for ourselves. What is this ourself? It's the wrong self anyway. We're not keeping it then for ourselves. We're keeping it for a pot pile of ashes. If you really want to keep something for ourself, where ourself is part of Krishna, that's actually using it for ourself. So better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. You know, we don't need to be misers. Not going to use this, I'm not going to use this, I'm not going to use this. This I'm going to keep from Krishna, this I'm going to keep from Krishna, this I'm going to keep from. And it will be distributed anyway after our death. Whatever we've tried to keep from Krishna, whatever we've tried to keep for myself, not even knowing who I am. Crazy, isn't it? It's almost like if you you're playing a character in a play and you're putting things aside for that character. But you're not the character. Why not pleasing with the riches one is destined to lose at death? So this can be a model for our whole life. Why not please Krishna with what I'm destined to lose at death anyway? Why not use this body to please Krishna? Why not use my mind to please Krishna? Why not give it to Krishna? I have to give it anyway. I have to give it anyway. Do I want to give it in love? Voluntarily? In a way that brings me happiness? Or do I want to give it by force, involuntarily, in a way that gives me distress? That's really the choice. That's the only choice. There really isn't any other choice. Do I want to spend my energy and my wealth and my this and my that voluntarily out of love to please Krishna in a way that also will please me now and forever? Or do I want these things forcibly taken away from me against my will and used in ways that have no benefit for me ever? So better to give with a warm hand than a cold hand. Why not please him with the riches one is destined to lose at death? So questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions. Is Giriraj having trouble with his turban there? Yeah. Maybe he doesn't want to wear that one today. It's okay now? He just wanted you to fuss over him. Yeah. Questions, comments? Yes.
I would like to ask, should devotees give donations to non-devoted organizations, to some other organizations or
beggars?
Should we give donations to people who are not devotees, other charitable organizations and other beggars? You know, that depends. That depends. There was one time when Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was walking with some of his householder disciples and they refused to give money to beggars and he really chastised them. So it depends. It's very individual. Even giving donations to devotees is individual. You have to look at what is the particular circumstance. The question is, will it please Krishna? What's your motive for giving? What's your motive for not giving? And will Krishna be pleased? A lot of that depends on who you are and what is your situation. I mean, if you're acting as a kshatriya, if you're government, the government is supposed to be maintaining the people who are injured or poor and things like that. That's the business of the kshatriyas. They're supposed to take the tax money and they're supposed to give it in charity not only to the brahmanas, but they're also supposed to give it in charity to the widows and the orphans and the sick and the injured, and the government is supposed to take care of disasters and catastrophes. That's their business. So if that's what you're doing, if you're a kshatriya, then you must do that. It's part of your vow. And we find also that the Vaishyas and the Kshatriyas in the scriptures, especially on festival days, would give charity to everybody. Yes? 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 Like at Govardhan Puja, they're giving, Nanda Maharaj is giving charity to the Chandalas and everyone, the dogs, and to everyone without discrimination. So there are certainly certain times when one just gives charity to everybody. And there's an example like that also in the 20th chapter of the 10th canto, which Prabhupada talks about, of course, in Krishna book, how the great, I think it's compared to the rain, that the rain is like a very charitable person that gives to everybody without discrimination. Prabhupada says sometimes the rich person just opens up their treasury house and just gives to everyone. So that may be. We were talking about Rantidev. So Rantidev gave his food to a Brahmana, he gave his food to a Shudra, and he gave his food to a Chandala. He didn't say, oh, you're a Chandala, I'm not going to give you any food. So it depends. It depends. Certainly you don't want to give charity to something that's going to encourage sinful activities. So you don't want to give charity to something that's going to encourage meat eating, intoxication, gambling, illicit sex. That would be a very bad idea, because then you also become implicated in those activities. Is that all right? But you can't make a blanket statement and say, you always should or you always shouldn't. That wouldn't be you know. Yes.
I wanted to thank you for the 2 points that ring in my mind very much. I just want to tell them. The concept of varna applies only in Grihastha ashram. This is something that I never thought about.
Uh-huh.
And with the other Grihastha ashram, the rest of the society would fall apart. And you said it like this, directly, and like it was like, yeah. Otherwise, it's not the society, it's just a piece of the society.
Yeah.
And my question is, you said that we should have this. Everybody should have this mood of sannyas.
Yes.
And sometimes I see when I have in my life this mood of renouncing everything, then I also renounce the activity.
Uh-huh. You don't just renounce the fruits, you renounce the activity.
Yeah.
Well, renouncing of the activities, Krishna says in the 6th chapter, that renouncing the activities is one who's very advanced in yoga. Actually renouncing the activities itself. And then again, it depends on what is your varna and what is your ashram, what are you supposed to renounce. And Krishna says in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that for one who's only taking pleasure in the self, for one who is atma rati, that means who loves the self, for one who is atma santosh, one who is very satisfied with the self, and what's the other one? It means who is illuminated in the self. I can't remember the word. So for one who's in love with their self, who's illuminated in the self, and who's satisfied in the self, they have no need to do anything in the world. But, Krishna also says, they have no need to renounce anything either.
Atma-tripta.
Thank you very much. Atma-tripta. So atma-tripta means to be illuminated in the self. So they have no reason to do anything and no reason not to do anything. The reason, generally, that a person, when they start feeling detached, wants to give up the activity, and this is going to be a little heavy, so is that all right? Okay. Okay. Sometimes people ask questions where you don't know how to answer it without being a little heavy, and it's like you never want to be heavy with people, so it's a little tricky. Is that means that the reason we're doing the activity is wrong. And that as soon as that motive is gone, we don't want to do the activity anymore. That's what it means. When we start feeling detached and think, well, I'm going to give up this activity. I mean, some activities should be given up. If you're engaged in illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, gambling, you know, murder, lying, cheating, stealing, and it's good to give up those activities. But as far as our ordinary activities in the world, if I'm doing this activity in a fruitive way, thinking I'm doing this activity in order to get a particular result, which then I will enjoy. And this activity is therefore a shelter for me. This activity is a means of fulfilling my desires. Once we see that those desires are foolish, then we think, well, why should I do the activity anymore?
Yeah.
Exactly. But what we're supposed to change is our motive for doing the activity. Okay, I was doing this activity for the wrong motive. Let me change my motive. Let me do this activity to please Krishna. So just like, you know, a man may bring his wife jewelry so that the woman will cook him lasagna and have sex with him or tell him that he's a hero or something. That may be his motive. You know, let me buy my wife a diamond bracelet and then she'll want to please me. And if he sees, oh, this is foolish. I don't need my wife to please me to be happy. This just means I'm using her for my own sense gratification. I'm thinking of her as an object that's here to fulfill my desires, and that's really nasty, and I don't really need that anyway. I can get my desires filled with Krishna. So then, okay, why bother to buy her a diamond bracelet? But one could also say, well, but it says in the Shastra that the man is supposed to give his wife jewelry. And it's my duty, it does say that in the Shastra. And that it's my duty as a husband to take care of this jiva. This jiva is under my care. And this jiva is given to me by Krishna. This jiva doesn't belong to me. This jiva is not my wife. This jiva is Krishna's property. This jiva is Krishna's servant. And Krishna said to me, basically, please take care of this jiva for me. And please take care of this jiva in the role of a husband and wife. And if I'm going to take care of this jiva, I not only have to give this jiva harinam and prasadam, but maybe I have to give this jiva some jewelry too. Because that's where they are at this point in their life. Like, you have to give your children a toy to play. And then it becomes wonderful. Then you're not doing it so the wife will be pleased. She may be pleased, she may not be pleased. But you're doing it so Krishna will be pleased. And then whether your wife is pleased with you or not, and whether she cooks the lasagna or not, is irrelevant. Does that make sense? You know, if I'm running a business thinking the reason I'm running a business is I want to like make a lot of money, and I want to make a lot of money so I can have a really big house and a big flat screen TV and a BMW in the garage, you know, and everybody will say, wow, what a house you have. You know, once you realize those things are all completely foolish, what does it matter? When I'm being cremated, if there was a BMW or a Volkswagen in my garage. Who cares? Nobody, not even me. I won't care. What does it matter when I'm out of this body if everybody says what a wonderful house I have? Who cares? It's irrelevant. And then you think, okay, I just won't work anymore. Why bother working? But if one's a householder, one's supposed to work to maintain the whole society. One's not just working for oneself. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I see my family as your maidservants and your manservants. These are all your servants, and I'm working to take care of them. You know, what's the difference between making sure the brahmacharis in the temple are taken care of, if you're the temple president, if you're the temple commander, and you're the temple treasurer, you've got to make sure the brahmacharis are taken care of, and making sure your wife and children are taken care of? There's no difference. If you can imagine, you know, if the temple treasurer said, well, we're not going to give any money to the brahmacharis in the ashram, that's all maya. That would be absurd. Wouldn't it? Oh, we don't have to feed them. We don't have to give them any dhotis. You know, we don't have to turn the heat on when it's -10. Why bother? Just all a bunch of ashes anyway, who cares? We'd say, wait a minute, this is impersonalism. So if you're a grihastha, then that's your temple. Your home is your temple. You're the temple president. Seriously. Your home is your temple, and you're the temple president, and this is your ashram. It's called the grihastha ashram, and you're taking care of the people in your ashram. Maybe it's a temple with only you in it. Maybe you're the only ashram resident in your temple, but it's still a temple. Prabhupada would say one person can go and start a temple. So if one person goes and starts a temple, and to maintain that temple they get a job, is that maya? Is that maya? And if it's part of their maintaining the temple, if they also eat, is there something wrong with that? But we say, okay, you can start a temple, but you can't eat. That's madness. So it depends how you're thinking. If you're thinking, I've gotten this house because I want to have a house, and I want an income, and I want this, and I want that, and I'll also have my little altar here, and I'll put my deities on the altar, and they'll bless my house. And I'll do a little bit for Krishna. Okay, that's nice. You can probably go to the heavenly planets with that. You know, that's nice. It is nice. It's a lot nicer than most people on the planet. But if instead you think, I'm going to start a temple, and here's my flat, or here's my room, or here's my house, but it's a temple. I'm starting a temple here. And I have my altar, and I'm maintaining the temple. Maybe all you do in your temple is chant Hare Krishna, but that's also a temple. Prabhupada said in Vrindavan there's 5,000 temples. Most of those are just people's homes. So if you think like that, then everything switches. Then Sundabhagavacharanamanu, Bhaktivinoda Thakur sings, he says, when I look around my house, I see Goloka Vrindavan. Right? When I drink the Charanamrita, I'm tasting the Ganga. Because I see my house is Goloka Vrindavan. Why not? If you have Radha Krishna on your altar, you don't think that Vrindavan's there too? You have Lord Chaitanya on your altar. Don't you think that Navadvipa's now in your house? Then how is it your house? And then it's so exciting to do all those things. Then it's just so exciting. It's so exciting to earn the money to maintain Lord Chaitanya's temple. I get to maintain Lord Chaitanya's house. I mean, you know that pastime when Lord Chaitanya asked his wife for a garland, his wife, his mother for a garland? You know that? When he was young. He asked his mother, can you please give me a garland so I can worship the Ganga? And she says, oh, just a minute. And he says, I want it now. She says, just a minute, Nimai. I want it now. And he had a tantrum. And he broke everything in the house. Everything. He broke all the clay pots of grains and oils, and it must have been a humongous mess. And he broke down all the walls, everything. And then he was tired, and he laid out on the ground and went to sleep. And then he woke up, and he's like, what did I do? And Satyamata came to him and she said, look, it's your house, Nimai. It belongs to you. If you want to break it, that's your business. I have no objection. She said, but now I have no way, I can't cook. You've destroyed my kitchen and you've destroyed all of the ingredients and I don't have any means to cook. He said, I'll take care. So he went into the village and he came back with some gold. And she was thinking, where did my son get all this gold? She kept asking the neighbors, anybody know? So if you were one of those people who could give gold to Nimai, wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't you like doing that? Well, that's what we're doing. You know, we're earning a livelihood. We're giving the money to Lord Chaitanya, or to Radha, whoever you worship, like Jagannath, Radha Krishna, to your guru. And whoever, whatever other people you're maintaining, those are the people living in the ashram. Those are your ashramas. And you can say, well, they're not all perfectly Krishna conscious. Neither are all the brahmacharis living in all of our temple ashrams. Sorry. Right? Are you always perfectly 100% Krishna conscious? You don't have to answer that question. Then you'll talk to me about if you were, would you be honest about it, or would you be humble, and we'll get into that discussion. But you understand what I'm saying. You can't say that everyone living in every single Hare Krishna temple is a perfectly 100% pure devotee. I don't think anybody would agree with that statement. So you can't say that, well, my family members, they're not all 100% pure devotees, therefore I don't want to maintain them. No, Krishna's giving them to you. So you see like that. Then everything becomes blissful. Then your whole life becomes blissful. Then you start feeling that you're living in the spiritual world, even in this body. Because you are. Because then everything you're doing is going into the right account. Of course, there may be a time when one will stop those activities. That's the idea of vanaprastha and sannyas. There comes a time, the children are grown up, you're ready to retire from your work. Vanaprastha means you're done. You no longer want a varna. You no longer care about an income. You no longer want to do something for the world. You know, you ask young people, what do you want to do? And they'll generally say, I want to do something wonderful for the world. You get to a point that you've done your something wonderful for the world and you're done. I don't want to do that anymore, finish. And your children, if you marry, of course people are supposed to marry young, but that, anyway. If you marry young and have your children young, then when you come to the point of natural renunciation, they're grown up. Nowadays things are kind of strange. That's, you know, biologically, psychologically, you get to a point, they call it the midlife crisis, where you just say, I don't really want to do this anymore. I'm kind of done. And if you got married when you were 20 and you had your baby right away, you know, then when you're ready to be done, you're actually done. Your babies are grown up and they're married and they're on your own and you've already finished your business and you've done all those desires in Krishna's service and then you can say, okay, I'm done. And then you're free and your mind's not disturbed. Your mind isn't thinking, oh, I'm ready. You just say, you already did that. Oh, yeah, okay, fine. And then you're back.
makes sense? And after a while, the mind stops crying. So at first, the mind's going, "Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. You already did that. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, what about this? You did that already. Oh, yeah. Okay." And after a while, the mind just is quiet. It doesn't bother you anymore. So it does come to that point. It's supposed to. In a normal ashram, ashram means the life cycle, and if people follow the ashram system, then that also comes. It comes to a point where even doing that for Krishna stops. Is that okay? It's a very long answer, but I hope it was okay. Probably we should stop here unless somebody has something really. Yes, please.
No, comment just regarding this question regarding charity. Since almost everyone is sinful on somebody eating meat on the vessel, it's very troublesome, and we have a nice solution for that, how to don't be misers, it's prasadam.
Yes, of course you can always distribute prasadam. A prophet says the best charity is the holy name. It says that in an active instruction. The best charity is the holy name. But there may be some times when you want to give money to somebody. I don't think we can say absolutely. I don't think we can make, judging by that activity with Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, I don't think you can say it is an absolute, that it's absolutely forbidden.
I think discrimination is very important to whom we give it.
Definitely.
Because they are not so sinful. In India, nobody eats meat.
That may be.
In that time, so to say.
But there are also people in the West who are not so sinful, frankly. There are. I mean, you're surprised? There are.
Yeah, some who are maybe vegetarian.
There are. There are people in the West who are interested in Rajagun or even Sattvagun. I mean, I was preaching at a program in Hawaii some months ago where it was a whole group of Sattvagun people. They were all just into Sattvagun. They weren't interested in Bhakti so much. You know, that was my mission, to try to bring them from Sattva to Bhakti. Sometimes it's harder to bring people from Sattva to Bhakti. Wow. Because they're already so satisfied, you know. They're already full of knowledge and happiness, and they think they have everything. So sometimes those are the most difficult audiences. But yeah, those were people who were, they're vegetarian. They weren't breaking any of the principles. They were engaged in meditation and so forth and so on. I mean, they were mostly impersonalists. But there were different people like that. But anyway, you can't make it as an absolute rule that one should never give money to anybody unless they're, you know, absolutely free from all sinful activities. You can't say that as an absolute rule. But generally, the charity that we should give to people is the holy name and the books and persona. That's the best charity. But yes, one should be discriminating. Definitely one should be discriminating. And one should be discriminating even in terms of what we give in Krishna consciousness. And we should not only discriminate as to the object of our charity, I talked about this briefly. Sometimes devotees think the only kind of discrimination we should have is who is the object of our charity, but we should also have discrimination into what is our motive for giving charity. Are we going to be resentful about giving our charity? And how we give our charity? Do we give our charity with respect, at a proper time, at a proper place, and without wanting anything in return, without wanting some prestige or something like that, or even thinking, you know, I'm going to get this back and I'm going to be rich later in my next life because I'm giving so much, or, you know, and without resentment, without thinking, Prabhupada says in that purport, he's without thinking afterwards, oh, why did I give so much? I shouldn't have given that. Now I wanted it for myself, and with some regret afterwards. So that our discrimination should involve all of those things. And in really studying about charity, my conclusion is that we should be extremely, extremely careful never to pressure people to give charity of money, time, or energy, or talent to anything unless they really feel it from their heart. And this should be something very important. We shouldn't go to devotees and say, you have to give to this, you have to give to this because it's service. But people should be able to give to what is inspiring them from their heart. I see that as a really important thing, teaching people discrimination. Is that all? Thank you for bringing that up. All right. Why not please him with the riches one is destined to lose at death? Srila Prabhupada ki jai.